Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 9th of August 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, and I will be joined by a live video Skype link by Alex Thompson from Eastern Approaches. And of course, Alex will be talking from the Netherlands heartlands. Well, I'm delighted to say the weather in Plymouth, at least, is blue sky and sunshine. So a little bit of summer has crept back here. We've got reports of sun from other places around the country, although North Wales is apparently a little bit cool. Well, what's happening in UK? We're obviously getting to a very, very interesting stage. Chaos is unfolding, huge confusion in government. But of course, many people have now drifted away from Brexit. It's all gone very quiet. But we'd like to thank Alex for digging out this article, which is about the editor of the Financial Times, who's been honoured by France for his positive role in the EU debate. What that really means is spinning things to assist the European Union. And credit where it's due, the original source, we believe, came from Guido Fawkes. And on his blog, he actually put up a copy of the letter, which we'll just expand on screen. And I believe, Alex, you're going to talk us through this one.
So I am.
The letter is on screen now, so take us away.
Yes, I can see it on screen there. I've also printed it out because it's too good to miss. This is the tweet debacle of the decade. And it's a reason par excellence to put on an Inspector Clouseau accent, because this is something straight out of Clouseau. So here we go. The message from the French embassy says, "Dear Monsieur Barbert de Lanel, I'm pleased to inform you that on the proposal of the Minister of Foreign Affairs and this embassy, the French president has appointed you to the rank of Chevalier in the Ordre National de la Légion d'Honneur by decree of the 6th of July 2016. Through this award, France wants to recognize your remarkable career, your contribution to high-quality journalism, and the Financial Times' positive role in the European debate." There you have it. A positive role in the European debate. And then he burkishly tweets this out, thinking he's doing a private message on Twitter to LW, whoever crony that if his that is, saying, "Morning, LW, I wanted to share this with you confidentially, because not good publicity in UK right now." So there he is with a lot of egg on his face. So there you see that the French embassy is very interested in correct coverage of the European debate.
And, of course, they wouldn't have sent that letter to him unless they were pretty confident that he was going to receive it in a positive manner. So we can now start to see the very collusion between the EU project and the press and media in UK that was highlighted so well by Mr. Dave Barmby from the Whitney constituency. And, of course, David Barmby and others have done a great deal of work to show that this manipulation of the press and media was also carried out on a vast scale in order to spin and get the propaganda across to the British public in 1975. So nothing new. All we've got is what do we say, slicker media in 2016.
Well, yes, the media makes it easier to report this stuff because of the internetization of the world, and it also allows us to blow the cover off this more. The French embassy is doing nothing unique in world diplomacy here. Because the EU does effectively diplomacy for all the EU countries now, particularly in poorer parts of the world where there's an EU representation and not necessarily a French and a British embassy, what this leaves the national diplomats with to do is not very much. And in my years at GCHQ, of course, I saw the telegrams. This is at unclassified level or restricted, so nothing too sensitive, but telegrams saying, "Please push British business." But a lot of it was cultural Marxism with no particular nation attached to it, just an agenda of please encourage people in that godforsaken country to, to recycle more or whatever. And so we give gongs to foreign citizens on much the same basis. We don't make them a knight chevalier in the Order of the Légion d'Honneur. We do it a bit more subtly than that. But we do similar things to award people for whatever the interests of the ruling clique are.
Indeed. And we'll just say, of course, it's all gone desperately quiet there on Brexit. no big rush by Theresa May to get Britain out of the European Union. It's all very complicated. It's too difficult for the public to understand, but don't worry, Theresa's got it all in hand. Well, certainly she's got the Chinese in hand, and we thought we'd come back to the saga of Britain's nuclear power station. The BBC here reporting that China warns of a crucial juncture over the Hinkley power plant delay. But of course, the real headline should be that it's communist China, and it's communist China that is threatening the UK over production of our very own nuclear infrastructure. So these were some of the key points. The communist China is funding a third of the £18 billion project. But of course, that money is going to be spent to effectively buy into details of Britain's strategic nuclear infrastructure. As an ex-military man, I find this quite unbelievable, treason at best, with a mixture of unbelievable incompetence. MI5, according to the BBC, believes that the Chinese intelligence services have been working against UK interests at home and abroad. Interested in your comments on that in a second, Alex. But we've also got this, that China's ambassador has apparently outlined what he believed were the benefits of a new nuclear power station in the UK and the strength of his country's expertise in the sector. Well, of course, we can't fault him for pushing his own country's expertise. But here we are, Britain in 2016. And of course, we've had all of our nuclear engineering expertise simply destroyed by our own government. Alex, what's your take on allowing communist China to simply bury its nose into our nuclear industry?
I think it's a good means of national suicide, Brian. The French have already been flagging up for months that the steel that the Chinese are going to provide to EDF in France and to us in Britain is substandard, or at least not tested. And not just in steel terms, but anything right through to telecom infrastructure. Huawei, which is increasingly being seen, especially here on the European continent, less in Britain, I think, as a manufacturer of cheap consumer goods, is majority owned by the People's Liberation Army. And even the names of the army and of the police, which is the Public Security Bureau, tell us what kind of country communist China is. It became politically incorrect to say communist China about the time that we de-recognized Taiwan and recognized the PRC instead and brought that into the United Nations with Nixon's diplomacy. Kissinger, of course, was crucial to that, wasn't he, which tells us a thing or two.
Indeed.
There's a lot of fellow travellers in the West. Do you remember the Maoist era, by Brian, where everyone was running dogs and lap dogs and fellow travellers and so on? Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, just in the Department of Education in Washington, D.C., there's people who string up Maoist educational slogans on red banners with yellow characters on them. You know, it's getting perilously close to an indication that China and North Korea are pet projects of certain people in Washington and New York.
Indeed, and I thought it would be appropriate to just remind the public in 2016 that, of course, we are dealing with communist China. Well, if the British government is getting a little bit squidgy over communist China and nuclear weapons, they're pretty squidgy over the subject of Israel and nuclear weapons. And this independent article here says it all, that unfortunately key documents have been lost. Israel nuclear weapons. UK government loses the file on its involvement with the country's arsenal. Labour's Tristram Hunt describes missing National Archive files as a worrying loss. That must be the understatement of the century, I think, Alex. But another file simply lost by the British government, presumably too embarrassing, a bit like the child abuse files.
Oh, yeah, this is not just any old file, Brian, is it? I mean, I've got the title of the file here. You know that the National Archives keep the titles separate for indexing, so even if the document itself has been filched, you can still see the index of it. And the document was 1979, and it was entitled Military and Nuclear Collaboration with Israel, Israeli Nuclear Armament. And this was in the era when the Israelis were making noises about nuclear arms, remember, after the two sudden wars they'd had in 67 and 73, 74, beg your pardon, with the Arab neighbours. And a few years after this, you had the hoo-ha in the 1980s of South Africa, which was a pariah state for the purposes of most countries, together with Israel, getting together and striking this Faustian pact, right, that Israel had the technology but no spare land to do a nuclear explosion trial, and South Africa had these remote rocks in the Indian Ocean. So Israeli technology was taken out to South Africa, the explosion was monitored, and Israel and South Africa were then put on the list in Western countries of naughty countries, along with India and Pakistan, that had nuclear technology but shouldn't. There's been suggestions that the French actually provided or sold or whatever that nuclear technology to Israel in the first place. And now there's a suggestion that we assisted the Israelis. In international law terms, Israel had already breached its bounds in 1967.
Well, of course, those are all just terrible allegations, Alex, because unfortunately the file has been lost, and I'm sure that there's no truth in the allegations, and the file's gone, so presumably that's the end of the problem. Maybe not. But we just remind people that Theresa May herself seems to be heavily aligned to Israel, and I would thank one of our viewers for pointing this out to us. So we've got here the Board of Deputies of British Jews. This is from their website, so it's a screenshot from their own website. We've got Eric Pickles and Theresa May and many other people holding up little signs saying Je suis Youf, if I've pronounced that correctly. And I was also pointed through to this particular ceremony where Theresa May is engaging fully with the Israeli community, Jewish community. And I'm going to remind people, of course, that it was David Cameron who pledged his unbreakable support for Israel. So I think it's reasonable that we ask the same question. To whom does Theresa May owe her allegiance, Britain or Israel? And this is on the basis, of course, that no man can have two masters. That's a fairly simple statement. So who is it, Theresa May? Is it Britain that you support, or are you actually working for Israel? Or am I being too hard on this lady, Alex?
You're not being too hard on her, but it's just because it's Israel and she's a pastor's daughter. And like me, she will have been brought up to have an instinctive sympathy for the Jews as God's chosen people of old. But the question is, how much does that map on to the modern state of Israel? Large swathes of the church, particularly in the US, but also in Britain, are of the opinion that the modern nation state of Israel, even the post-1967, post-international law breach state, is an act of God and you can't speak against it. But I'm not suggesting Theresa May was brought up with that opinion herself, but because that opinion exists, it is rather difficult to say, with regard to Israel, what you could say to any of the other 200 countries in the world, which is, how can you pledge allegiance to this state and still be the head of government of this state? It's an Independence Day event that she was attending there. But of course, if I'm not mistaken, the Hebrew letters there on the pulpit were saying eternal capital, or certainly the second word was olam, eternal. So Israel's claim to occupy that land eternally, regardless of who's on it. I don't know. I think the jury's out. From a Christian point of view, on whether Israel is an act of God in its 1947, 1948 onwards form, but it's a country in the world. And if you're a government, even if you're a government made up of Christians, your job is to look after the national interest of your own people.
Well, thank you for that, Alex. I would just add to that, I would just like our politicians to be open and honest about what they're doing. And of course, we've got the remarkable situation of many MPs who are conservative friends of Israel. What would the British nation be saying if our MPs were all conservative friends of Italy and were paying attention to Italian politics in a beneficial, prejudicial way? But this is the BBC's latest scoop, troops on the ground in Syria. And again, thank you very much to a viewer who pointed this one out to me last night. We've got the BBC crowing that it's giving the first look at Britain's secretive and lethal force in Syria. And it says it's obtained exclusive photographic evidence showing for the first time British special forces operating inside Syria. Now, I'll just take our viewers through a little bit of this. And Alex, we can have a very interesting discussion on what's going here. But have a look at this. British special forces are apparently helping to defend a Syrian rebel base against the so-called Islamic State. Now, this is all part of a video clip, and the base is identified, if I remember correctly. So what is going on here? The BBC is, I think, attempting to put out the claim that Britain is there fighting the nasty terrorists inside Syria instead of conducting what we would consider to be regime change in Syria. But it goes on because apparently after viewing these pictures, the Ministry of Defence said it would not comment on special forces operations. So if that's true, the BBC must have put the lives of these special forces men, possibly women, at risk, which is a very interesting state of affairs. So the BBC, we're going to discuss whether those forces should or should not be in Syria, but they are in Syria. They're doing an exceptionally dangerous job, and the BBC is simply prepared to put out details of those units. So we'll follow along. We've got this. They come out with the extraordinary statement that these soldiers, unlike conventional troops, do not need parliamentary approval to be deployed. So we can ask the question, because of course the BBC doesn't ask that question, if this isn't something that our democratically elected parliament deals with, who actually deployed them. And if we take that through in a little bit more detail, we've got this. We've now got a private army apparently operating in Syria. They're deployed in secret to help the good terrorists, but the BBC knows and broadcasts the location, strength, and the special forces mission. That seems an extraordinary thing to do. Ministry of Defence seems unaware of the whole proceedings. Westminster MPs and the public have been completely left in the dark. So we're going to say who is responsible and accountable for the troops on the ground when David Cameron said there would be no troops on the ground. Alex, I'll just let you comment on that. I've got a little bit more to take our viewers and listeners through, but what an extraordinary situation that the BBC pops up out of nowhere, apparently. It broadcasts details of the strength of this operation, and it thinks in doing so that it's got a press scoop. Before I give any more, what's your take on it so far?
It is technically treason for the BBC to disclose these troop strengths and positions and deployments. But I'm not going to blame the BBC journalists ultimately, because their constitutional illiteracy has blown the whistle on that, blown the lid on that, that they don't know any better. They haven't researched it and deliberately committed treason. The illiteracy I'm referring to is the fact that they say these troops do not need parliamentary approval, which I'll get to in a moment. But I would blame more some of the specialisms which have mushroomed within the special forces, the SAS and the SBS, don't forget the Special Boat Service, who take a lot of the world as well, alongside the SAS. Because starting about 10 years ago, there have been officers who have been largely there to manage the media in the special forces. I had an occasion where I actually opened a bottle of wine for the commanding officer, the Lieutenant Colonel of the SAS. My mother could never believe that he didn't have a corkscrew of his own with all the gadgetry they carry, but there you are. And so I poured him a wine, and he was there to thank us coves for all the support we'd given to him. And I noticed then that what I had been told is that CO22 SAS, he's known, the commander of the SAS, would never in the past have gone outside Hereford to thank anyone for anything. So he was starting then to butter up the current CO then, was buttering up the agencies, and then it went outwards in concentric circles to the point where they were courting the media. And I think what they've got wind of is they are the handy bit of our armed forces which is going to survive what David Ellis keeps warning about as already happening, and Tebbit and Farage as well, which is the subsuming of all our military into the EU. The useful bit that we're going to contribute is going to be our special forces. So they're trying to get ahead of that process by courting the media and selling themselves. You know, cut the rest of the Army, Navy and Air Force to the bone, but please leave the SAS and SPS alone, even though, of course, they've had to slash their reserve units, 2-1 and 2-3, which were not up to scratch, I'm afraid, with the rest of 2-2. So I think ultimately the Machiavellian machinations here are within the SAS itself. Now, we can get onto royal prerogative, but essentially, unlike the US Constitution, where we have specific, where they have specific directions that the president cannot commit troops to war without going to Congress, at least post hoc, after deployment, we don't have that. And so until very recently, all military deployments were under royal prerogative, and there was not even a parliamentary convention of debating their deployment. It was, if I'm not mistaken, in the Iraq War in 2003, for the first time in the run-up to that, that Blair promised that Parliament would get a debate, but that was explicitly exclusive of special forces deployments. Of course, you've got to be able to move troops in secret, but what do other large countries like Russia, the US, France do? They have vetted parliamentarians within their intelligence and defence committees in Parliament who get wind of it, so that at least someone in Parliament has given a go-ahead for the deployment of special forces. We're left with this situation where we have this royal prerogative with the Parliament, which the Prime Minister can deploy at will. And so we've basically replaced the Stuart, the 17th century tyranny of the crown with a tyranny of the government instead. You know, we've got divine right of Parliament instead of divine right of kings.
And that is a very scary concept. Well, something I found interesting when I went to look back at statements that Cameron had made to do with troops on the ground, I couldn't find them. The only place that I could find reference to, of course, David Cameron's repeated statements that he would not put troops on the ground in Syria were carried by Russia Today. So have those other news reports been wiped out? I don't know. But here we've got one of the Russia Today ones. Cameron rejects Tony Blair's call to send ground troops into Syria. That was apparently the 27th of May 2016. And the other Russia Today one was this one. Cameron rules out British ground troops in case for Syria airstrikes. So a very interesting state of affairs that basically those statements, we won't put troops on the ground. Clearly there are troops on the ground. The British public has no idea what's going on, but the BBC is crowing. It knows exactly what's going on. So this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's, of course, very serious in line with your remarks about the power of David Cameron. We say, who runs Britain's private army? Well, of course, Westminster and the public are not entitled to know where British troops are being used overseas. We've got a private army deployed without debate in Parliament. So who's in charge? Is it Michael Fallon, Defence Secretary? Maybe it's Tony Hall, the Director General of the BBC. He seems to know where the troops are. Perhaps he's in charge. Could it be Alex Younger, the head of MI6, obviously involved in very shadowy operations overseas? Could be David Cameron himself, his private army. It could indeed be Mark Carney from the Bank of England. What we do know, of course, is that as Prime Minister, it's got to be a responsibility of Theresa May. But as we've just heard, she seems to be building an allegiance directly to Israel. So if I was really cynical, I could ask, is it perhaps Israel that's controlling British special forces operating in Syria? And we'll just bring in the man concerned. Here he is. This is the BBC reporter. It's Quinton Somerville. What can we say? Well, why was this man allowed to report the location and strength of British special forces? Was this a contrived propaganda broadcast? That's a possibility. Or was there a remarkable coincidence and he just stumbled upon the group by chance? Perhaps somebody could calculate the statistics on that one. But either way, we think there's some very serious questions to be asked in the public interest. Before we leave this extraordinary situation, British troops on the ground in Syria, we don't know, the BBC does. What should we do about this, Alex? What should the public do in response?
those who are interested in the Constitution can insist that the Constitution be adhered to, and the old way of doing that, of course, is write to your MP. Unfortunately, we know that MPs bin letters, even quite senior ones have been photographed doing it. So it is a time for peaceful, direct action, I think, which is difficult enough because you can't protest on Parliament Square anymore without being cleared out. So most of the things that the public could do which would have any teeth against our government have already been foreseen and legislated against. Ultimately, I think it's a question of getting rid of the current crop of MPs and putting in local men who have individually stood up before their own electorates and said, I will insist on knowing in advance about troop deployments. Obviously, only a few can be in a closed committee where special forces are deployed, but that has to go through Parliament. We're often told the Queen is just a symbolic figurehead, and indeed she doesn't personally know. Well, she'll give the nod, but she doesn't think and strategise about special forces deployments. But it's all done in her name by the Prime Minister. And of course, if it's done in someone's name, then you've got the question of powers behind the throne. We've got to avoid that and have Parliament deciding these things. And that requires a fresh crop of MPs. If we don't elect a fresh crop of MPs who don't have party loyalties, this will go on and foreign and special interests will continue to direct our troops.
Indeed. And of course, the whole situation with ISIS in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, etc., is ramping up the fear. We've got this report from the police. We've had this before. We just remind people because Sir Bernard Hogan Howe said it was a case of when, not if, terrorists struck. People were being told to run, hide and tell. And these were the basic instructions that could help save lives. We said, how does Commissioner Mark Rowley justify this advice? Because does he actually know better than somebody who may be on the spot actually seeing the problem unfold in front of them? But we're all to be terrified of the terrorists. Who created those terrorists is a very interesting question. And then we've got this situation that the police marksman, in this case used against a criminal, are now getting unhappy that they're being brought in front of courts effectively. He says, my former colleagues are saying we will stand by for a Paris-type attack, but when you want us to go out and do an intelligence-led operation against criminals, you might need to satisfy us that the intelligence is perfect or we're not going out. So the warning from this police marksman, firearms officer, is very, very pertinent. He's saying we're being put out on the streets with the potential to kill people, but who are the people we're being directed against? I think this is a very, very important case that the mainstream press at the moment, Alex, are not picking up on the true significance, because who is the person, who are the people who are directing so many armed police to be so fearful of terrorists? Who's identified those terrorists?
Well, these people like to manoeuvre themselves into position. I well remember getting into work on the 7th of July 2005, having heard what was then still being called on the breakfast news, people having had a fire on the tube and coming out with blackened faces. And I got into work and was immediately put on shift work until the November of that year, related to the 7/7. And the first briefing I got, this woman, very bureaucratic type, who obviously couldn't think for herself, who didn't want to, said, reading from a script, blah, 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 and Cressida Dick has been put in charge of the whole operation. She is bronze command, or was it silver or gold, I forget. But the way in which she spat out the word Cressida Dick was quite impressive, and she'd obviously got vibes from London End that this is the woman to obey. She is going to be commanding, and of course she still was a couple of weeks later when Giancarlo Stimenezes was shot. So these people are in very influential positions indeed. And if you go back a century to when we had all kinds of things after the First World War, we had soldiers coming back at a loose end, robbing shops, a few of them, and Irish terrorism in its early stages. How was that defeated in London in those days? Well, men were armed, as they are allowed to be under the Bill of Rights, 1689. And so instead of sending out a few men with super weapons who didn't know the situation as it had developed, you had local men who would, in many cases, overpower, aim the gun or shoot if necessary at the man themselves, whom they had seen to be causing a threat or to have shot, Or in many cases, the police would come, and then the men would turn over, the local bystanders would turn over their pistols to constables if the constables ran out of ammunition. A much safer way of doing things, of course, with a very low terrorism rate in those days, despite the many threats after the First World War. And then, of course, what did? We confiscated all the guns. Well, I say we, but the state had no power to do it. It was all done through Home Office policy and police guidelines and licensing laws. But ultimately, an armed populace is the way to stop these kinds of attacks.
Alex, that latter point, very, very interesting, and I think we must have further discussion on that. You've mentioned the name Cressida Dick, and of course my instant response to that is let us remember that she was a very high-level, common-purpose future leader chosen by this pernicious political charity in order to become a world leader, in fact. And my goodness, the damage that we've seen Miss Dick do is just incredible in that field. But what has the terrorist fear achieved? Well, of course, one of the things it's achieved is to split MPs away from their constituents. And the Plymouth Herald, our local newspaper here, is saying it all. Plymouth MPs review security arrangements amid growing safety fears. So these pathetic MPs, three shown on the right of your screen there, are so frightened of this terror fear scam that they need extra revenue to pay for their protection in case any of their constituents get a little bit aggressive. Of course, Gary Streeter featured there, centre of the column of three MPs, was all too keen to get the bombs raining in on Syria, and he defended his Conservative colleague Brooks Newmark when it emerged that Brooks Newmark was making unsubstantiated claims that Assad was using chemical weapons. So our MPs, I believe, Alex, are under attack here, and the agenda is to make the MPs scared of ordinary people, and then you can drive a wedge right into the heart of the democratic process so that people have nobody to turn to when they realise that their own government is committing treason.
Yes, we've already seen this with the first MP in the country who's effectively suspended her constituent surgeries is none other than Angela Eagle, the MP for one of the Wirral seats, I forget which, but Wallasey, I think. But anyway, she was the first who said, the police have advised me it's not safe. So people in that constituency have got no connection to Parliament now, at least not in person. I mean, they can write, but then it's so much easier to be fobbed off in writing, isn't it? You can't get the nuances across. So you're voting for people who you're never going to see in the flesh, a bit like on the continent where people, the people who represent you are just picked by the party. You just vote for the party and the party fills in the rest because it knows your own mind, apparently. We're heading that way, aren't we? And then you've got no accountability whatsoever.
Indeed. Well, staying on the BBC, we better move across to the subject of child abuse. And I think that this is one of the most sickening headlines that I have seen today on the subject from the BBC. What have they got to say? They're asking whether the Goddard chair of the abuse inquiry is the most toxic job description in public life. And this is how they deal with it. They say, established in 2014, the inquiry is not simply a public inquiry. It's a vast six-decade retrospective exercise in national soul-searching. Just have a think about what that really means. There's little doubt that children were sexually abused in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and beyond across many public and private institutions. Remarkable statement from a BBC that had difficulty believing there was abuse inside the BBC over that period. But then they say it took a series of scandals, most notably that of serial child abuser Jimmy Savile, to really change perceptions. The inquiry must delve into the national psyche and institutions of decades past and carry out extensive examinations of how they operated in relation to children. So this is all abuse is somebody else's problem, not the BBC's. It all took place in the past. We need to have a little look at it and see where they failed. Then we'll learn from the mistakes and carry on abusing the children. I've got to say, Alex, when I read this particular headline, the BBC has become the most disgusting organisation in their double dealing on particularly child abuse issues.
Yes, Brian, and I would put the Daily Mail in second place. And what ties them together is that you have had personal dealings with BBC and Daily Mail journalists, perhaps more than any other outlets, saying, would you like to talk to our sources on child abuse? And they have said, no, no, no. And eventually they've said, Mr. Gerrish, please hand over your sources and stay out of it, basically, you know, hand this to the big boys. And that BBC piece by the correspondent you've shared is very similar to one that appeared in the Daily Mail a few days ago after Goddard resigned, which basically said at the end, of course, we can't believe the victims, and this is far too big a job for one person's intellect, so maybe we ought not to have an inquiry after all.
It's all too difficult, except if they want to pin the label on who the abusers are. So bring in the Daily Express, and here is the headline, Rotherham Abuse Scandal, Horrific Reality of Industrial-Scale Child Grooming, and Who's Responsible? Well, apparently it's now Kashmiri men. So we've been through the Asians, we've targeted the Muslims, we're now so desperate to keep people's eye off white members of parliament and white establishment abusers, that we're now going to blame it on Kashmiri men. But of course, the headline is admitting that the scale of the abuse across the country is industrial. And what does the BBC say? Well, we just need to have a look at where some of these organisations got it wrong and learn some lessons. Well, this was a comment from Gavin Thomas, the president of the Police Superintendents Association. And he confirms what we've just heard, that there are so many paedophiles, we can't jail them all. So what we need to do is have a softer approach for lower levels of crime. And what he means by that is people viewing child pornography. But of course, as one of our correspondents pointed out, that in viewing child pornography, children are being abused in front of your very eyes. But this policeman thinks, well, it's much more important that we let some of these people off. And of course, we certainly want to let off the politicians and senior establishment figures and senior police officers and military people involved in the abuse of children. Well, the Sunday Times helped the process because it attacked Justice Goddard, pantomime dame, out of her depth and out of a job. They were crowing that the inquiry had lost its chairman. The Daily Mail got on board as well. She didn't resign. She was sacked. And essentially, the article tried to point out that she was sort of not up to the job. I would believe that she was threatened to an extent. She decided she was safer to leave it. But have a look at this, because this takes the biscuit. A journalist called David Rose from the Mail, and he's effectively saying that VIP child abuse is a scam. He says the multi-million pound industry run by lawyers seeking damages for abuse survivors has established a strong financial motive for those prepared to lie. And where police, politicians and, yes, public inquiries have made clear that their bias is towards believing the victims, there is little risk of such perjury being exposed. And on it goes. Mrs. May announced the formation of the inquiry on the day after Leon Britton was, we now know, falsely accused of rape. The febrile claims of VIP paedophile ring embracing not only sexual depravity but multiple child murders, peddled by the now defunct website Exaro and disgracefully the BBC, followed swiftly in its wake. Unusually, amongst journalists, we can reveal, Rose has repeatedly drawn attention to the dangers of wrongful convictions for historic sex abuse, starting with a 2000 BBC Panorama programme, which he reported and wrote in the name of the children. Alex, my opinion says that specialist people are being brought in order to help confuse the public and close down the notion that we have serious paedophile activity, not only in the BBC, but inside the British government. These people are carefully moved into position and their articles are carefully crafted to defend abusers. But what a statement that we might actually believe some of the child abuse victims. I'm lost for words, really.
Clearly, Brian, the public was believing the victims too much when they were speaking through, shall we say, ordinary journalists. And so a few of these specialists, as you call them, were brought in. And as we've heard they're described with David Rose, he was unusual among journalists in pointing out that people had false memories or stood to gain financially. So things that hadn't crossed the journalists' heads when it was ordinary journalists reporting were suddenly inflated by a few of these placemen. So, yeah, you can see what's going on there.
Well, we can. And let's force this point, because we'll bring in the Telegraph. And here it is, the headline: name now Dame Lowell has quit. The great child abuse inquiry should stop too. Yep, let's not investigate industrial scale child abuse. This is Charles Moore. And this is what he says: the accusations against Leon Britt and Lord Bramwell and the late Edward Heath, which had moved Labour's deputy leader Tom Watson to abuse parliamentary privilege and claim clear intelligence of a powerful paedophile network with links to Parliament and Number 10, were discredited by, here we are, BBC, Panorama and others. The massive industry of child abuse campaigners and lawyers, it is an industry. It's just about people making money. For them, the inquiry is a dream come true, and in some cases, a livelihood. So we've got Charles Moore, same ilk: let's close down the child abuse inquiry. He can't understand it, apparently, when we have, amongst other senior police officers, saying this is industrial scale abuse. UK column has revealed a Metropolitan Police officer talking about the cover-up of child abuse by politicians and senior police officers. But Mr. Moore from the Telegraph doesn't have the mental acumen to actually understand what's going on. And then we can point out the deviousness of the whole inquiry, because let's remember what Justice Goddard said at the beginning. She said it was a statutory inquiry that will be entirely independent of government. That statement was completely untrue, because the whole inquiry, of course, was closely controlled and monitored by Theresa May and the Home Office. Here's Jana, and The Guardian is trying to claim that the Goddard inquiry is still going, and it's going to contact UK spies for any intelligence about the accusations made against Lord Jana. British spies are to be approached by lawyers for the official child sex abuse inquiry, requesting any intelligence gathered on the late Labour peer Grenville Jana. And Ben Emerson QC, counsel to the independent inquiry — see the words being used, independent — said his team had spoken to MI5, and they're going to be contacting MI6 and GCHQ for any files held relating to Lord Jana. And for those of you that like numbers, there had mysteriously been 33 complainants in a total of 13 investigations. This is complete nonsense, Alex, because, of course, if I just pop this one up on screen, I'll then give you the stage, as it were. Here we've got an article from The Mirror, which was reporting accurately that MI5 had essentially closed down an investigation into a paedophile, saying at the present stage the risk of political embarrassment to the government is rather greater than the security danger. And the Cabinet Office admitted that the risk to children wasn't even considered. Are our intelligence services going to assist? Personally, I don't think so, but what do you think?
Well, even if they're minded to assist, Brian, the question is, how would they do it? I mean, if you get an order as someone sitting at a desk in an intelligence agency to look through your files for mentions of Jana, then that would be just as it would be for freedom of information requests or subject access requests made to an agency, where people get this email circulated around saying, Mr. Jones of Acacia Avenue has complained, look through your files. So what do people do? They do a quick search for the name. And of course, the name's not there, because this stuff is in people's heads or in old files in the basement. It's not on computer files that they use these days. So they just perform the search, if they're diligent, or just read the name on the email as it appears and say, well, I don't know that name, so I can't have anything on it, and leave it aside. And that's it. So obviously there's going to be a blank return, and the agencies are going to say, we have nothing on Janet. But the question should be an intelligent approach of sitting down the older and more senior members of the agencies and looking them in the eye and saying, on your oath, do you know anything about Janet? That's how to do things properly, but of course it's not. It's going to be done bureaucratically.
Alex, well, I can reinforce that comment because I was contacted a little while ago by a person who said that they'd actually spoken to police who were forming the supposed inquiry into abuse allegations against Edward Heath. They gave a report about what was well known in the location of his home, and they also... well, they made a formal report. Now, of course, what they were saying was historical. It was hearsay. Nothing happened for months. But eventually they were contacted by a member of the police who said that they were there following up on what they'd reported. And during the conversation, it emerged that the particular officer, a single police officer, was in a location with some 50 or 60 desks, which were empty. He was the only person put forward to investigate Ted Heath and child abuse. And of course, that inquiry went nowhere. But the government's solution, as you've picked up, is to stop child abuse, we need to give children more sex education. And you'd pushed out this Guardian article.
I've summarised what the authoress, Vera Baird QC, says as this: to stop children being debased, the state must debase them all in primary. And I think that's a fair summary of what Vera Baird has said. If you remember, this is the flame-haired lady who was Labour MP for Redcar through the Blair and Brown years, and latterly she was the Solicitor General for Blair and Brown. And she's since become one of these police and crime commissioners for Northumbria. And she, in fact, chairs the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. And if you look at the Guardian author page for her, you will see among her arrogant poses to the camera that her most recent piece before this was in January when she wrote Why Police and Crime Commissioners Are Here to Stay. First line of that is, as a police and crime commissioner for Northumbria, I oversee the budget. I make savings of £2.9 million. I hold the chief constable to account. I scrutinise services and I engage with the community. So we're getting more of a hint now as to the correct mould of person who is intended to become a PCC. And UK Column Workers found out that the PCCs are unsackable. Of course, in a couple of counties, people have elected non-establishment candidates, which they were not supposed to do. And if that happens, you have relentless attacks on them. But this is a political commissar of the kind who was intended to become a police and crime commissioner to steer the police the right way. And from her vantage point of authority, I'm reading out now from the article in question where she's looking up at the camera in a sassy pose. And she's saying that she has this coalition behind her to make sex education obligatory in primary, including religious schools. She has got the Commons Education Committee, the Commons Home Affairs Committee, the chairs of the Committees for Women and Equalities, for Health and for Business, Innovation and Skills. The Children's Commissioner for England is strongly in favour, as is the Chief Medical Officer, the Labour front bench, two Royal Societies, six Medical Royal Colleges, all the teaching unions and my Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. So who could we possibly be to say we do not want our children to be taught about sexual parts at age six?
Indeed. And if we want to look at somebody, a political zealot, we better go north of the border. We've got Nippy Nicola Sturgeon here. And let's just remind ourselves that this is the lady who did not want to go near the Brian and Janice Doherty case, where a couple have four children removed from them, not because they've committed any crime, not because they've abused their children or harmed those children or neglected those children in any way, but simply because they dared to report the approach of a paedophile. And the response from Ms. Sturgeon, well, she ran for cover and gave the dirty deal to her head of media, Eileen Easton. And Ms. Easton was simply prepared to put out a line, and the line is that Nicola Sturgeon doesn't intervene in individual cases. So it's very strange that in Scotland in particular, we can see the First Minister not wanting to go near anything to do with exposing paedophiles. But of course, you've discovered that Scotland is scoring pretty high on the atheist score chart.
Yes, this I don't know who Statista are at bottom right, but they have produced this graphic, which is drawing on data not from the Office of National Statistics, although I think it's based on ONS census data, but it's based on this NatSen, which we'll talk about in a moment. No, nothing to do with the Scot Nats, but it appears to be overlapping later. So Scotland has leapfrogged Wales, which in the 2011 census was the most godless part of the United Kingdom. Now Scotland is the part of the UK, according to the same data, who say that they have no religion. I haven't come across this interpretation before, but it's based on the 2011 census, and now you have Scotland in the lead. Now everyone knows that the Celtic fringe is more religious and has more committed Christians than any part of England. And so what this is reflecting is the polarisation of Scotland and Wales, much more than England and Northern Ireland, where anyone who has left church going is immediately flipping over to ardent and strident secularism of the Dawkins mould, really, and the SNP leadership kind, you know, get religion out of here, we want a new age morality. So it shows the depth of the commitment of the Scottish and Welsh people, to their shame, I have to say, to the new religion, which is a lot worse than the old one. And believe me, if you think you had problems with Christianity, wait till you see how this religion pans out.
Indeed. And you've also been having a look at who is looking at us. So you've got the social research centre here. Tell us a bit about this one. We'll just bring up this front page. It says British social attitudes, religious decline comes to a halt. And top right hand corner, it says click here for Scot Sen.
Yes, that there's no Wales Sen or Ulster Sen or North Sen or West Sen or anything like that, or London Sen, but there is a Scot Sen. And by the way, while we're on that page, the PDF that you can get from that page, British Social Attitudes Survey, gives you the details which show that Anglicanism, not Christianity, Anglicanism has collapsed. 1983, 40% of respondents said they were Anglican. 2012, 21%. 2015, 17% said they're Anglicans. Catholics stayed very consistent between 9 and 11% throughout the period. Other Christians, very consistent at 17, 18%. Non-Christian, largely Muslims, went up from 2 to 8%. No religion only went up from 31 to 48%. So basically the new atheists are ex-Anglicans. It's the default lazy position. These weren't church-going Anglicans in 1983. These were people who said Church of England, because their parents and grandparents had put that on their forms in army life and school and whatever. And they flipped to the new lazy default, which is atheist. You see, so that's the section that's been hit, but also the Church of England is culpable there because it's not a religion anymore, it's a political agenda. So we see this NatSen, and we see that it has a special Scot Sen. And do you have another slide on that, Brian?
Indeed I do. I'll just call up the Scot Sen, and there's a little bit of text here. It says, we're the Scottish arm of Britain's largest independent social research agency. For over 10 years, we've worked for government and charities to find out what people really think about important social issues. So I was reassured straight away because they say they're independent.
Uh-huh. They're independent and they are very numerous. I mean, for a country of 5 million, Scotland is needing an awful lot of social number crunching. And this ties in with what David Scott has repeatedly pointed out, and I think we need to hammer on about. Scotland is a testbed, as are parts of Australia. And the population there is being experimented on to see what works in the whole of the English-speaking world, at least, and probably in the future Europe as well. So another day we may investigate the who's who of the Scot Sen page, but it goes on and on and on. They've got no end of researchers. I think the Scots are going to end up like the Australian Aborigines. There was an Aborigine who was approached in the 90s, I think, by an academic researcher who said, I think your people have got this special gift in visual intelligence. Can I investigate? And the Aboriginal elder said, sorry, mate, we're experimented out down here. Yeah. And I think Scotland is approaching that position now.
Indeed. Well, we'll just finish on the NatSen because on this screenshot, we can show who they're connected with. Remember, they're independent. They're working with Age UK, University College London, the General Medical Council, the Ministry of Justice. So they're clearly independent of government. The BBC, well, that's an independent broadcaster. And HSCIC, I don't know what that is. So these organisations are not independent at all.
No, they're all third sector, aren't they? They're interested in doing things to us, not for us. If you're doing things for the people, you're public sector. If you're taking the public's money and giving them services, that's also doing things for them, and that's private sector. If you're doing neither of those things, you're in the middle, you're the third sector. And although they don't like to say it, what makes them distinctive is that they do things to people.
two people. And we'll end on your little example here from Holland as to the fact we are really just lab rats, and we've got your own Gradener who is boasting that he's got his PhD.
Yes, Dutch universities are particularly bad at hiding agendas, the usual Dutch explicitness about everything they do. So this chap, Jeroen, is saying he received his PhD last month in social sciences at Utrecht University for his dissertation, which he entitled Keys to the Community. And here's the description. It's a multiple case study on professional legitimation in community development practices. The study examines how community development professionals obtain a sense of legitimacy in their work with local communities. Based on field research in Chelsea, USA, Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and Doornkop, South Africa, the building blocks of their sense of legitimacy and the strategies they apply to obtain it are outlined in depth. Who would want to fund that kind of research?
The government, I would suggest, Alex, whether it's the Dutch government or the British government. And many, many years ago, I got very interested after I discovered what was called the longitudinal studies, which were looking at generations of British families, everything, their education, their health, their wealth, their jobs, number of children, their religious beliefs. And I got a very strange feeling that people who could not be trusted were literally beginning to look at us and run us as if we were lab rats. Final 10 seconds summing up as you'd like, and I think it's time to close.
We are the product. David Scott takes credit for that line, not me. One of our Scots viewers is saying, is Scotland really the test bed? Yes, I'm afraid it is. And David will continue to explain how that is and why, but largely because it has a passive population which trusts its leaders more. But that will come to an end, of course, as it has done in the past in Scottish history. Here in the Netherlands, we take the lead in experimenting with digital things, because people in the Netherlands are quite happy to be given chip cards instead of rail tickets and then to be told that that's the only way to travel. So England and Wales are slightly behind in that agenda, but you need to keep your eyes out because this thing approaches us country by country. And the more we look at cross connections between countries, the more we can resist it, which is why I'm glad that UK Column has got a growing viewership around the world.
Alex, thank you very much, and thank you for joining us. I will say thank you to all our viewers and listeners for joining us. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider taking out a subscription, or if you can, making a donation. We can only do what we do with your assistance, and indeed we would like to expand the number of programs that we're carrying out at the moment. And it is remarkable, but probably 90% of the people who contact us wanting to get out information, truth, their personal stories about what's taken place in their lives, they are all desperately short of money to travel, to have phone calls, to print off documents. And if we are to report what really needs to be reported, we need to have some flexibility financially in order to travel to meet other people, or indeed to pay for them to travel to meet us. And we're also now getting to the situation where it's clear that some people need safe housing. They need safe houses in order to protect them from the worst of the British state or the Scottish state or the Irish state. And we can only look to try and provide that sort of help if you will help us. So do have a think about that. That brings us to the end of today's news. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.